Here we are, WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 on your radio dial, getting ready to take off with another Counselor's Cafe. Before we do that, let's go to a little bit of music right off the bat. A little bit of music about radio.
Out from silver, the 12:30 on the dash. I had a thermos full of coffee and a pocket full of cash. Radio. Just me and you again. And you are the midnight preacher. I listen to the wheel spin. Listen to the wheel spin. NCW out of Spindale kept me going until 3. And I want to thank.
Well, this is WCOM that's going to keep you going all day, 24/7. And we were just listening to a little bit of Jonathan Bird and radio. Good morning, and welcome back to the Counselor's Cafe. And this is where we focus on the care and feeding of the mind, the psyche, the spirit, whatever it is that makes us human. Conscious of self, capable of change, and free to make choices. A little psychology, a little philosophy, and maybe a little bit of something else. And what we've been doing the last couple of weeks is exploring the nature of existence, a continuing conversation with Paul Nage and Rocco.
Paul, I think it's broad enough.
Yes, right. The nature of existence. That means we've got the floors wide open. Paul is the host of Touchstones here at WCOM on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. And Rocco, of course, does Saturday Morning Music Hall, which really starts the weekend off. Thanks for being here, both of you.
It's always a pleasure.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Today's discussion is going to explore the obstacles to spiritual progress, according to an ancient Upanishad. Join in the question with... in the discussion with any questions or comments you may have by calling 929-9601. If you can't call right now, you can always get in touch later by emailing counselorscafe@nc.rr.com or by writing to Counselor, 200, Box 6, 200 West Weaver Street, Carrboro, North Carolina, 27510, and let me know what it is you'd like to talk about. And while I'm talking about getting in touch, check out WCOM's website at www.communityradio.coop. Take our listener survey. Explore all the great shows we have on here. And look at that little icon up in the upper left-hand corner, this Donate Now. All listener-supported, all volunteer, Community Radio. Another brief break, and... then we'll be back. And this time it is The Snake Song, one of my favorites that Jonathan has on his CD, The Waitress.
Snake is like a memory. Half is gone before you see. Gone before you can think to run. A
snake is like a memory. I'd like to shake hands with a snake. I don't care what you people say. If I had my take between a dollar and a snake, I'd take the snake any day. A snake is like a memory. Half is gone before you see. Gone before you can think too much. A snake is like a memory. I'd go to church with a snake. We'd sit back on our tails and sway. Eternity don't make that much difference to a snake. Forever is a hot summer day. A snake is like a memory. Half is gone before you see. Gone before you can think too much. A snake is like a memory. I'd go to town with a snake. We'd hang out in the parking lot. Snakes don't care that much for chain stores and such, but they appreciate a nice big sunny spot. A snake is like a memory. Half is gone before you see. Gone before you can't think too much. A snake is like a memory. A snake is like a memory. A snake is like a memory. A snake is like a memory.
Jonathan Bird from the CD called The Waitress, which has some really, some of my favorite pieces on it.
Yeah,
there.
Jonathan Bird, he's a local boy. Not only that, but he writes all his own music, and he's just getting better and better. So this is a guy to watch for and support.
Absolutely.
And you can find him on the internet on jonathanbird.com.
I've seen him a number of times.
That's BYRD, right?
BYRD, yeah. Yes, he's played at
Weaver Street.
He's actually
Cat's
come
Cradle.
Here and played.
He's been in here with us at the studio.
He's an incredibly talented musician. Okay, we've got a number of things that we can kick off with today, and the first of which is this list.
You know, the question is why am I not supremely happy and blissful like the... ancient sages say I should be.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the Upanishads says, well, there's 20 obstacles in people's life that keeps them from realizing this. Hunger.
That's a big one. I remember a professor saying to me once, what mother is going to join the PTA when she's digging in the ground for roots to feed her kids?
Yeah. We'll discuss these at length.
Okay, go ahead.
And then we'll do thirst. Laziness. This, of course, is the great obstacle that I am an pure embodiment of. Passion. Lust. Now, I used to think it was lust, but I've discovered that it was laziness. Fear. Shame. Anxiety. Excitement. Adversity. Sorrow. Despair. Anger. Arrogance. Delusion. Greed. Stinginess, ambitiousness, death and birth. So
death and birth are both obstacles to enlightenment.
Yeah, they get in the way, you know. We're so busy dying or being born that we aren't thinking about being supremely blissful. So I think it would be kind of fun. That's just a list from an Upanishad, the actual... The exact citation isn't given, but I thought it would be kind of nice to go through this.
Some of them
I could dispute for a variety of reasons.
Well, don't you think all of them change as you get older and go through life.
It definitely changes. And one of the things in looking at this that stirred something in my memory, and I went on the internet to find it immediately, and that's Carlos Castaneda and the four natural enemies of the man of knowledge, of going through the path of knowledge. And he's only got four. And it was fear, clarity, power, and the last one was old age. The desire to rest. You get tired of conquering all these enemies.
That's
and
right.
They finally conquer you because you're tired.
Things change for you as you get older.
Uh-huh.
The warrior.
Some for the better.
Yeah.
Some for the better.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Old warriors don't die. They just fade away. Right? Somebody said that somewhere.
I think General MacArthur said that.
Yeah.
It could be.
And, of course,
or
he was
didn't he say, I shall
famous
return?
Army general. I said
after,
a lot of
that's
things.
After he returned, yeah.
Yes.
So hunger and thirst are classic ones. You know, those are the ones, you know, that people often come up with as... well, you know, it doesn't really make sense to be thinking about, you know, personal bliss when so many people are hungry and so many people can't get good water anymore.
Going back to Maslow's hierarchy of human needs.
Right. Yeah. And also going back to what Dyer was saying when we were talking about last week is how do you focus on reaching what he calls the source when you know, and be positive in your thought, when you know that all this suffering is going on. And he says that your concern over it is never going to change it. You know, you have to do something.
However, in my natural, I led with those because I have a naturally contrarian nature.
Oh, that's good.
And the fact of the matter is the... You know, deliberate fasting and also deliberate thirsting, the deliberate withholding of water, were techniques that were used by ascetics in the deserts to bring on trance and visions, which there was their idea of getting messages from the gods. So that,
but that's a choice.
Judicious hunger and judicious thirst. And we could go through all of these in a lot of ways and say that each one of these obstacles is used like a slingshot to take you beyond them, you know, in a certain way. And, of course, that's what the purposes of spiritual practices are.
Well, have either of you two ever been hungry or thirsty and not be able to get something to eat or drink in your life?
When I was fasting, yeah.
And but that was self-imposed. You had that choice.
I didn't think so. I was told I had to fast.
Well, it shows you
was
the
my
abundance
choice.
Of
I
this
think
country.
The I have
the
never gone hungry,
choice.
But I have had the threat of hunger at some time when I had all those kids. And, you know, finances were not always... fantastic, and it was, how am I going to feed these kids? It was never to the point that we ever went without food.
That's what I mean.
But the worry was there from time to time.
As Americans and as people, and the three of us, we probably have a combined age of over 200 years here.
So 2,000.
We're not teenagers.
Right.
And we've been around a while. Uh-huh. And
that's
very
right.
Experienced.
Go back to the Revolutionary War, folks.
But it's hard to find people in this country that were not able to get something to drink or something to eat
somewhere.
Well, it's possible, of
I've
course.
Got a, we have I've got a past history of working with human service organizations in this town, and we have, in this wonderfully rich setting of Chapel Hill at Carrboro, we have hunger, we have poverty, we have homelessness. We have all the ills that you can think of.
No, we also have people that have it hard to have a basic sanitation, that they still do not have indoor plumbing.
And naming of this station, who is the only station in the country with an outhouse.
Yes, including including the station in which we have a house outhouse. But
fortunately, we have other
We are
options.
Complaining, though, people. We're actually very grateful that we have any place to broadcast from.
Yes.
You know? We are at the station on, you know, be running around in a mobile van parked in various
pirate
places.
Pirate radio.
Yeah, pirate radio.
But, you know, that might change for the better. You know, I always try to
be the optimist, and
see that
it will.
Things get better.
The station is growing, and it's getting more expansive and more stable. And yeah.
Better programming.
Yep, of course, right here. Okay, what else are we doing? The
other one is laziness, which is an interesting... that's a simple term. You know, there was another term for laziness, which is actually different. It's actually closer to what we would call depression, which was called acedia. This is a this is one of the seven deadly sins. It wasn't laziness.
It wasn't
or sloth.
It's not sloth.
It was acedia.
And acedia is
an interesting kind of despair in which you just don't care about anything anymore.
Okay.
And it's corrosive in the way that depression is corrosive.
Apathy. Right.
But more of an antipathy into the apathy. In other words, it really is corrosive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody who is a true cynic. I remember I told a friend of mine who tended. This is when I was quite young, when I was in my 20s. And so was he, and he was a natural cynic, you know. And I said, "Oh, you're a natural cynic, you know," and I meant it as it was a kind of humor. No, he was a real cynic. I mean, he really thought the world was coming down.
The world was coming down.
Well, yeah, everything and nothing worked. People were out to get him. You know, there's a degree of a paranoia in it.
I had someone ask me one time who I thought was lazier, teenagers or old people. And I didn't know what to tell them. And at the time, I was working as a short order cook in a restaurant up north.
Now, by the way, that is one occupation that if you are lazy at, they fire you quickly.
Exactly. And this fellow was saying, "I'll never hire a teenager or an old person to do this job."
You know, and that makes me jump immediately to the idea of laziness and who is making the judgment. Because I had been told as I was growing up that I was lazy. And it wasn't that I was lazy, is that I didn't want to do what other people wanted me to do. So I wasn't accepting the chores. But so far as the things that I wanted to do, I had all the energy in the world for.
Yeah, I mean, I realize that when it comes to sweeping the floor, it only needs it once a year. Yeah. I mean, I know that there are other people out there that expect it to be swept once a week, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
And I can understand this and this thing, but, you know.
But then, it's recognizing choice. And mine, I think, was less laziness than it was... I don't like being told what to do. I don't necessarily want to do what your desires are. I want to follow my own route. So it was more...
Yeah, that's sort of a willfulness rather than laziness.
I think so.
Yeah, which is...
That's
a
good word for it.
And I don't know if we have anything close to willfulness here. Maybe under arrogance or delusion.
Yes, that could be too.
But whatever it is. But, you know...
How would laziness... prevent you from becoming enlightened or spiritual progress?
Well, you know, okay, so let's say that in order to become enlightened, you need to know yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to know yourself, you have to know yourself in ways that are not only ordinary, but slightly unordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you do that is you learn to meditate. This meditating allows you to know yourself in more ways than the ways that are oriented towards our cultural concerns or interpersonal activities.
Now, that's very interesting because I've read about meditation and I've engaged in it periodically.
And you never thought it had anything to do with
knowing myself.
Yeah, well, meditation is a way of knowing aspects of yourself that you are unlikely to know any other way.
Is this something that you need to have in your mind ahead of time before you start meditating? I'm meditating for this purpose.
What, to know yourself?
Yeah. Because meditate to
To relax, to be lazier.
But isn't meditate...
No, to transcend.
Oh, I thought that was to relax.
Isn't meditation...
to be lazier?
Yes.
Doesn't meditation involve work?
It involves purpose. you know, decision making, concentration, focus.
Have you ever noticed some people are very loud, mm-hmm. and they are self-centered, mm-hmm. and if you were to ask them to whisper, mm-hmm. that's tough for them to whisper because that involves an extra effort mm-hmm. to make the effort to be quiet and do it silent, do things not so selfishly.
Mm-hmm.
So whispering involves an example of work that some people have a tough time doing.
And maybe people who like to whisper all the time are really very lazy and want you to turn up the volume of your hearing rather than them. But actually,
as my brother used to tell me when I was a kid, was you mm-hmm. don't you need to project, Audrey? You need to project, and I said, no, you just need to get closer.
But you know, there's I noticed that these are paired. Like you have hunger and thirst, and laziness, mm-hmm. passion, and I think it's interesting here is that in classic Buddhist meditation, there's the twin evils of meditation. And one of them is falling asleep, you know.
Okay.
So every time you start meditating, you know, and then, which was, I'm accused of that all the time. And then, not when I'm meditating, but when I'm sitting anywhere. And then passion, of course, is when you're really agitated. You know, mm-hmm. you got something, and it's just running through your mind, you know. You know, that beautiful woman that you just saw, you know, and mm-hmm. of course she didn't notice you, but, you know, but even so, you just can't get her out of your mind, and, you know, and, wow. Okay, well.
Well, let's go from, since you're rolling your eyes over there, let's go from passion to lust, and mm-hmm. how are you going to separate them?
Why, it would why depend would on what to? You're lusting after.
You don't want
yeah.
to.
I mean, passion is foreplay. Do lust. I mean, everybody knows this.
But again, it depends on what you're lusting
yes.
after.
I mean, you can be passionate about saving the world and saving yes. the whales. You can yeah. be passionate about your yeah. job. So I'm thinking maybe passion is a desire to... Lust? I'll jump to lust. Lust seems to me is a desire to have, possess.
Or to satisfy oneself as and treat the other as an object.
Uh huh.
In other words, you're really only
money.
Meant as a you know you're just meant to scratch my itch. your itch don't matter.
What about lusting after
money?
Money.
Yeah.
Well, I knew a real estate.
Well, it's, again, it's to satisfy my own. Needs
desire
my
to have
desires.
To own to possess
to be free of pain, mm-hmm. you know, money as mm-hmm. a shield to be mm-hmm. protected. You know, this. I mean, there are positive reasons that people are selfish,
mm-hmm.
and lust is an active exercise of selfishness
of
self-concern over and against others' better interests.
That's what I think of it. Lust in connection with greed.
That's right.
As whereas passion, you can have a passion for, as I said, for saving the world. It's your full involvement.
You can be passionate about music.
Exactly. Exactly.
But in the classic meditation, you know, you have where you have laziness as falling asleep. Passion. Mm-hmm. is what's keeping you awake, but you don't want to get too passionate. You have to find the balance between the two.
Right, right. So
and that's what they're, and often with the meditation things and with the spiritual things, they're looking for balances.
Mm-hmm.
And any of these of in themselves represent extremes.
Right, right.
So we, shall we deal with lust so much more? We could actually spend the whole hour talking about
lust. I knew
lust.
A real estate agent. She used to go around taking people around looking at houses and telling them that she lusted after all these houses she was showing her clients.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
What
so
is
she
that
wanted
now?
To own, possess.
Right.
That's
she
it.
Would like to
I think in terms
have owned
of,
all those houses.
In relationships sometimes, people... will be attracted to another person not because they care about that person's welfare, but they want to own the person. They want to possess them.
But the trophy wife.
Exactly. This is my woman. This is my man. You know, it's like, wait a minute. These are, you know, free, independent people. They don't belong to anybody.
Yeah. Well, and there are people who... the classic one for me was Johnny Carson and his dotage.
Okay.
Well, you know, he got married several times.
Yes.
And you could see that the women he was picking were, one, they were attractive women, but they were catering totally to his arrogance and egotism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, so they were kind of like trophy wives. And they you know, kowtowed to this bargain, which was probably unconscious on the parts of, if not themselves, at least on the part of Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course what he did was found himself in this honey trap over and over again, you know. But, you know, and you know, so this is, you know, it's a classic, you know, thing. A man of wealth and fame, a woman finds him, caters to his worst worst characters, which he thinks, you know, of course, he thinks that's wonderful because, you know, there's suddenly finds somebody who whom he thinks is attractive, who thinks he's wonderful. Well, I mean, I've never known that myself, but I'm quite sure that I would be very susceptible to it.
Well, you know, Paul,
and suspicious.
It doesn't take much to change any equation. Really. If you throw money into it or take it away, multiple marriages or fame, any of these things can change the lifestyle and the personality of anyone.
And how does then, that is a blocking to your spiritual progress.
Yeah, but, or and you can think of spiritual progress as actually as a way of knowing yourself. I mean, that's the purpose of of what spiritual progress
Dyer
is.
Dyer would say that it's connection with the source.
Or knowing reality.
Right.
Which is, you know, of which yourself is not different.
Well, now, Castaneda says clarity or being clear-sighted can be sometimes an enemy because you are so sure that you see it all.
Well, that's a form of arrogance. I mean, you know, and it might be, and it could be based on a sense of surety. In other words, you know, I've been right in the past, and I've been right, and I've been right. So I can assume that I'm going to continue to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and before you know it, you're living in la-la land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, yeah, it's...
So, again, it's balance there, because when Castaneda talks about, you know, defeating or conquering your enemies... The natural enemy, and one being fear.
That's actually the next on the list here is fear.
Uh-huh.
Fear and shame. But fear is a big one. So is shame. You know, like in The Course in Miracles, which is that channel literature. You know, I mean, that's the one they're constantly talking about. You know, the reason we don't know anything is fear this and fear that. And fear becomes the big cosmic ash can in which all of our, all of these others... are just our reactions against our primal fear that we're going to disappear, that we don't really exist, that we're not worth anything, that we're completely unloved, that we're actually a fraud.
Instead of love making the world go around, I do think fear makes the world go around.
Well, I mean, we certainly had an exercise of that. And the classic thing of that exercise that in our society in this this decade is 9/11, and we had this a terrorist attack, and what was basically a horrendous criminal activity was turned into a political warrant to create war against a country. So what we did is we took a bunch of thugs who had a completely unrealistic religious political goal, and we turned it into a warrant for war, and then we went into the longest war we've ever had in our history, into another country that had nothing to do with these thugs. That is the insanity of exploitation of fear.
Exploitation of fear.
It was the exploitation of fear by our own leaders, the people that we trusted to be wise and to make good decisions. Instead, we elected a nincompoop who did it. Okay, but that's another story. That's an example
progress.
Of fear.
It's interfering
and of course, and of course, that fear and the exercise of that fear causes me to be filled with shame of being in a country that is so filled with so many idiots who would re-elect somebody like that.
Okay.
Now, shame is a profound one.
Yeah.
Well, what about What's the story?
I mean, education. You know, and educate. Shame is used over and over again in education.
Continuously.
And the way we do education in this country, we're constantly trying to get the kids to shape up by shaming them. Mm-hmm. By ridiculing them so that they lose face amongst their peers.
If you were to go around and ask most of the principals in the schools in the country, would they rather be feared by the kids or loved by the kids? Probably. Well, what do you think they would say?
Well, what would you say? You were a principal.
I would say they would rather be feared because they would want their policies and ideas carried out like the king. Would the king of a nation or kingdom, I was going to ask you, what was the story where he would rather be feared than loved?
Mm-hmm.
And fear seems to have that immediate effect on people. Everything could change in a moment if you become afraid, if somebody approaches
you. Well, it's
you
also the issue of what you want is obedience. See, in other words, what we
okay, bring it back to spiritual progress. How does it interfere with a spiritual progress?
How does shame?
Fear and or shame.
Yeah. Well, what they do is they distract from the considered ability to reason, to understand, to try out alternatives. In other words, hey, wait a minute. Maybe war isn't the right thing to be doing now. These people were not acting in the name of a state. Mm-hmm. They were acting in the name of some kind of crazy ideology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we need to think out who really was the bad guys rather than declaring war.
Mm-hmm.
A war that can never be won because it's not against any.
But do you think that fear will stop you in searching out something of a spiritual nature because you're afraid an angry God, you know, a Jeremiah.
Knowledge.
Okay.
Knowledge and the unknown will change the equation with fear. If you don't know something, you tend to be afraid.
Well,
you're afraid. Afraid of the dark because they don't know.
You know,
how
somebody says, ignorance is bliss, why isn't everybody happy, you know?
Because
I'm very happy, so I guess.
Yeah.
If you don't know something or you don't know what's going to happen next, you tend to be afraid of what might happen.
How
that's negative or bad.
When it's like fear of the unknown, and how do you get...
How do you get over that knowledge?
Well, how do you move from... No. Well, before that, because... Fear of the unknown and curiosity about the unknown. Fear of the unknown is going to make you avoid it, put it down. You know, we do this with cultures. We don't understand people of a different culture, so we're afraid of them when we call them names and all that other stuff. Curiosity, on the other hand, leads you towards the unknown. And we've got the big saying, you know, curiosity killed the cat.
Well, but curiosity...
But cats have nine lives.
But see, the thing about curiosity... is it allows you to entertain a variety of possibilities of what might be happening and to search for ones. Usually what happens is the first one that seems plausible is pounced upon and nobody looks any farther.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a few people immediately examine the one that has been pounced upon and says, you know, as the common wisdom, and say, well, maybe it doesn't work. You know, now, but you know, but what happens with shame, and shame is two-edged, because what you have is you have not only taking the issue of fear in a general sense, but you turn it back in on the self of the person.
Mm-hmm.
It's turned back. It's sort of like fear can be a natural response, like in startlement.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of it, you know, waking one up to issues of alarm that you should be concerned about. Then the question is then obviously what you have to do is you have to decide, and you don't decide in fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so but by prolonging fear and by bringing in anxiety, for instance, criticizing our leader when he made this drastic calculation. which I think was absurd at the time and still do, was immediately, people were said, you were being unpatriotic.
Right.
To criticize El Leader. Mm-hmm. Well, that's insane. You know, that's the kind of thing that the Nazis did when it came to Hitler. You know, it's not what we should be doing in America just because some idiots blew up our couple of big buildings. Mm-hmm. Do we immediately then decide that anything our leaders say and do should be beyond our consideration? And
so it's fear then that makes us concentrate on the leader, because we are scared, we've been frightened, and we want somebody to show us the way.
Jimmy Jones.
Protect us and keep us safe.
Yeah,
exactly.
And the shame anxiety is partly what does that, because the shame is creating a situation to where you're subordinate to whatever the rules are.
You give up your responsibility.
You give up your responsibility to the leader. So shame is, you know, one of the most pernicious forms of socialization that we mm-hmm. can do. And actually, it's one of the things that we should probably be working hard to change. A shame-based, mm-hmm. Behaviors create little authoritarian personalities. Authoritarian personalities look for the big leader to make decisions for them, and they obey the rules. That's not the kind of people we need in a democracy.
Would you bring guilt in with the shame? When you're talking about controlling people, you control with guilt.
Well, you control with shame more directly than with guilt. Guilt is.
I'm not going to name particular religious organizations, but I can think of one that is very heavy on learning on getting their point across.
Well,
by pushing guilt.
Yeah, see, Japan, for instance, and this is, I don't know how true this is still was, but it used to be considered that Japan and its high regimentation that it does, and it's
honor system.
Yeah, and it's all based on shame. It's very, very shame oriented.
You dishonor the family.
Now, it's true that what we do in America, because of our emphasis on individualism, is we take shame and we interiorize it so that you become the punisher of your own self, and that's guilt. So then what you've done is you've interiorized the shame system mm-hmm. to be self-interjected. So even though I know that no one saw me do that thing that I should be
ashamed of,
I will feel guilty about it
right.
because I know that I've done it. And that's pretty terrible when you think about it, especially when you're only 5 years old and you're feeling
folks,
like this.
You're listening to the Counselor's Cafe here at WCOM 103.5, and we're talking about things that are blocks or obstacles to spiritual progress. And I want to throw in here that even as a mirror, what is spiritual progress?
Mm-hmm.
Even as a mirror covered with dust shines brightly when cleaned, so the embodied soul seeking the truth of Atman realizes oneness, attains the goal of life, and becomes free from sorrow. Now, would you consider that the purpose of spiritual progress? To become free from sorrow? Again, going back to Dyer, connecting with the source? Is all these are what is stopping us from connecting with our real nature? And I'm going to throw Viktor Frankl in there also, who says, at the core, we are all perfect, and we just need to get through all these things that have crusted us like barnacles to get through to who we are as perfect entities. So this is what that's what the end goal is then. Is that correct? Or
yes, and of course, what I would say is that in order to know ourselves, once we know who we are truly,
mm-hmm.
then we do know that who we are truly is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that doesn't get translated necessarily into every behavior I do is exemplary.
Right.
It might be that most of my behaviors are exemplary.
Of course.
But not everyone. In other words, this doesn't mean that we're still human,
right?
It may be that deep down inside, me and the creator of the universe are no different.
Mm-hmm.
However, I am still, as a human being, a human.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Do either of you know of any society at any time in history that just sort of, I guess, goes with the premise of live and let live and takes everything that we're talking about and just lets it go and doesn't try to emphasize anything?
Doesn't try to find answers?
No, right.
Right, right. So
does not try to find answers, does not try to seek the source, the knowledge, the wisdom, the truth, all of it. Just live and let live, and that's it.
What are the Quakers like?
I'm not sure. Paul, I feel you know much more about the different
Quakers.
Religious groups than we do.
Yeah, well, I think that there are occasionally religious groups that will, you know, come up with like a slogan and say everything is there, like it's nice to be nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
But they, to me, would seem like they have a pretty strict code of mores and folkways and rules and regulations among themselves, and
who
a hierarchy of
the Quakers.
The Quakers.
Oh, well, yeah, actually, they're not hierarchical. And they tend to be, I mean, in some ways, the Quakers are as a social group generally, right? Not as any particular Quaker. But they tend to be non-authoritarian, you know.
Are
in
they
a way.
Rule-bound?
They're consensus-based.
They're very non-rule-bound.
Mm-hmm. And consensus-based.
Right.
Yeah, and they're non-authoritarian. In fact, they're so strongly non-authoritarian and non-rule-bound that they really represent a good alternative to the creeping authoritarianism that's still the basis of the way we socialize in our schools,
mm-hmm.
the way we expect people to behave when they take a job.
Mm-hmm.
You obey the boss,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the way that people are, according to one of my guests I had on here last week, she was talking about this, you know, she's a young scientist at UNC, and she's considering being a witch. And, you know, and she had a boyfriend for a while, and he wanted her to not go to school, not do graduate school, even though she had the degree and she had the scholarships to go,
mm-hmm.
and to stay home and to have babies and not to get any education,
mm-hmm.
and to obey him, because that's the way God wanted it and that's the way it was in the Bible.
Ah.
And she said, that's crazy.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, living
and
in this
society. I'm really happy that she saw that was crazy, because mm-hmm. unfortunately there are a lot of young women in our society who would not be so sure,
mm-hmm.
you know, who've been raised in a situation where they think that, you know, husband, daddy's boss, husband's
mm-hmm.
boss,
mm-hmm.
me, woman, me obey
mm-hmm.
and serve.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be okay if I obey these people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it'll work for a while, but you know, but in all likelihood, you're going to get mm-hmm. dumped on as he goes and pursues his trophy wife when he's 40. You know.
So again, we're talking about the barriers or the obstacles to spiritual progress, and just bringing up what you're saying, in this woman who had
a whole bunch more, by the way.
Right.
Yes. We haven't got through half the list yet.
But I'm thinking of the right of an individual to pursue his or her own spiritual progress, and this would seem that this gentleman that she was partnered with for a while wanted to. Well, he was another obstacle.
Well,
in her
and she said
sort.
Also, she said too that she said, you know, he said, I waited for him because he wanted me to when he was in the army.
Uh-huh.
And then when I come back and I say, well, I've got to go to school now, does he agree with me? No. He says no. He sets up his little fiefdom and say, no, you have to obey me. And he went out, and of course, when they separated, he went out and found a woman who would obey him.
Paul, you mentioned
but this authoritarianism, of which this is a form of authoritarianism. I mean, it sounds like it can work. Sounds like it can be benign. I had a Mormon on here who represented this wonderful benign authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. And I emphasized it in its greatest benignity. I did not create any, I did not try to, you know, needle him about what this was, because it was a system that worked very well for him, and everybody seemed comfortable with it. So I wanted that to be thing, but it isn't necessarily it doesn't necessarily work for the rest of us.
Paul, you mentioned the Japanese and the Shinto religion. Now, how would Shintoism differ from Buddhism? Is it more authoritarian or more rule bound? Or
actually, in Japanese society, actually, the Buddhist religion tends to be more authoritarian. Now, there are authoritarian aspects to Shinto, in as much as that the emperor is, you know, God incarnate on the planet. But the way Shinto was reinvented, especially after World War II, was to make it much more liberal oriented, and so it's actually, so it's funny, but though definitely pre-war Shinto was, you know, and through the emperor cult, gave this extreme form of authoritarianism in Japan in that particular context. The post-war Shinto has become a very liberalizing force in which there's sort of an equality of kami. The kami are the spirits that inhabit everything.
Well, if you look at what Japan has done since World War II, how they've just, you know, economically elevated their society and their country, and they've become so successful. I know they're having some problems now, but they pretty much stayed with their beliefs and their religion and what they felt was best for them. And I think a lot of American people don't know much about the Shinto faith.
No.
Well, actually, where I learned about Shinto was I was a member of this organization called the International Religious Association, and it was specifically for groups that were excluded from the Geneva group of all the Christian groups that get together. And you, in order to belong to that, you had to be a Christian, and you had to accept that Jesus is Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed an interreligious group that could accept all religions, Christian and as well as others. And while I was there, this is where I learned about this form, revised form of Shintoism. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there aren't other forms of Shintoism in Japan, that it isn't Hydra-headed, many styles of it, but this belief that everything is alive, basically, is what it is, and there are various forms of.
When you say everything is alive, you mean like rocks and
everything, everything, rocks,
the
everything,
Earth. Gaia,
trees, even to the point where buildings become alive, you know, and that whole thing is feng shui.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have you have something which is very much in our country now. It's its own religion now, which is Reiki, and it's a healing energy, and what that represents.
Mm-hmm.
I read something, it must have been about 10 years ago, about this everything is alive has to deal with the decay of the proton. I think for thousands of years, you know, people thought the atom was, you know, the smallest particle. And then, of course, when you get into subatomic physics, you've got many more particles, much smaller than the atom, that have been discovered. But for years, I think the science community believed that the proton was a part of the atom that did not decay and become basically nothing throughout the existence of the universe, sort of thing. And maybe that's when this came in, this belief of
everything being alive.
Where it changes and becomes something different.
Well, actually, no, I believe that the idea of everything comes alive is a very ancient idea. I think, and it's, it goes right back to animism, where everybody thinks that, you know.
Recently, in a more of a pop culture setting.
Yeah, it's more of a secondary rationalization.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, everything's alive, and maybe there's a subatomic theory that makes it seem plausible.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that, and I think that people who really believe or have an experience of everything being alive, get it through a basic kind of spiritual experience. What you have is you have your ordinary self-other walls and boundaries melt away, and you see that everything is living and has its own innate integrity and vibrates a form of love.
Well, if everything is alive, would that mean that nothing ever dies?
It does mean that.
But it could change its form to the point where you wouldn't recognize it.
That's the proton decaying.
Yeah,
you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Because it's
that's part of the atom.
And the idea is that energy cannot be destroyed, supposedly.
Well, birth and death are the things. And we're biological entities, and as biological entities, we were born and we will die. However, the part of us that is awareness itself may not be on the same thread of our thing. We might see a lot of people think that our awareness is an accident of our biology.
Mm-hmm.
It may be possible that our biology accesses our awareness, which is independent of our livingness. And in that way, when you get to these spiritual obstacles to spiritual progress, anxiety and excitement and adversity and sorrow, all of these are embodied forms of emotional entanglement, arrogance, delusion, greed, and also cognitive entanglement, stinginess, believing that money or not having it, ambitiousness, death and birth, all of those orientations are we're entangled in this. And what may be true, and as you said, Viktor Frankl thought it was, at our core we're pure.
Mm-hmm.
In our core we're not entangled. And once we have a sense of that, it becomes like a little light. That God can guide us to continuing to have a sense of it. Now, the reason we want to continue to have a sense of it is our little biological entity needs the continuing.
Mm-hmm.
The little light that's pure and not entangled doesn't need to be disentangled. What we need is to realize the simplicity, and the more we move towards that light, which is what the Quakers say.
Well,
the Quakers follow
jump
that
in
light
and say
too.
And argue
this
with
this little
the,
light of mine. I'm going to let
argue with death and birth as being obstacles to spiritual progress,
yes.
And to think of it more as birth and death actually identifying the route the spiritual progress takes. In other words, maybe we're born to get over all these things and understand that there is death.
I've talked to a number of people over the years, Audrey and Paul, that believe that when we don't remember birth.
Right.
We're all born, but do we remember what takes place?
Because we were so traumatized.
Well, a number of people have said to me that they believe that birth is very similar to death, in that when we die, the
we're not going to remember when we die either.
Well, they refer back to when a child is born, and as the child is moving through the birth canal of the mother and out into the light,
right,
that first light makes an imprint on our brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it stays with us forever as long as we're alive. And then, you know, you've heard of people who clinically die and they have these out-of-body experiences and they see the light.
They see the light.
There's something possibly connected with that when the body is in the stage of just dying and ending the physical presence, something clicks off in our brain and we go back to that birth moment.
And perhaps it is a birth into something that we still
know. Birth and life,
right.
Birth and death are very, very similar. Possibly.
Possibly.
You know,
right.
These are things that
Yeah.
No one knows the answer. Have you ever heard that?
Well, I haven't heard it exactly
that way,
but I do remember in, whatever the man's name is, who did this whole thing on death and dying. He did a program a number of years ago, and I...
These out-of-body,
see the light. Well, it's about the whole idea of how to go, you know, the fact that we are all going to die on... Bill Moyers, I think, on death and dying.
Well, death may be
and
very similar.
At the
similar
end of that,
birth.
They had a rabbi who said he describes this as if they had two twins ready to be born, and one of the twins is saying, "Oh, it's ready. It's time to go. It's time to go." And the other one's saying, "I'm not going out there. You don't know what's out there. There's nothing out there. We're going to go out there. We're not going to be anymore." And the other one's saying, "No, no. It's time to go. It's time to go."
Well,
so he was saying
he
was talking about death then as being a birth, the same thing as being like birth.
Well, that reminded me of
we've got like 2 minutes.
Oh, Santayana, the great American philosopher, who nobody reads because he wrote so well, talked about two kinds of mysticism. He called it immature mysticism, which is the baby who wants to stay in the womb, and it's based on fear and obedience. And then the heroic mysticism, as he called the other one, which should have been the other twin, that's ready to go out there and slay the dragons and face the fears and untangle the obstacles.
Spiritual
and know
progress.
That there are ways. And by the way, one of the ways that one can make spiritual progress is through the creative arts and through selfless giving. You know, giving charity or where it's needed and things. So there are ways to find that light within yourself and live by it, and not only to your own benefit, but to the benefit of others. And if you find that that following your own light harms other people, then you may need to think about how deeply that light is shining through you in terms of its harmless, transformative good. If it's harming other people, it may be that the light you're following isn't the true light, but is rather a light of greed, delusion, arrogance, stinginess, anger, despair, and sorrow.
And we're going to jump back and throw in as a last closing thing the things that Dyer did say to help overcome the obstacles to spiritual progress is live your life on purpose, be at peace with everyone, respect yourself, live a stress-free life, express your own genius, feel the abundance in the world rather than the lack, and you will attract ideal people and relationships and reach the source.
Audrey and Paul, I just want to say it's always a pleasure to be here discussing
these
things.
I'm so glad. I think
yes,
we've
it's
got
always
a nice
group
here.
It's always great that you're here. I mean, after all, this only, you know, I'll start sounding like a broken record, no doubt, after a while. So I'm glad.
Okay, this is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 FM.